Seachtain, an Indo Askeilige.
Lower and Wanchirna Elner Donaldson Lish and Ifagachin Akanir Lower Jeffrey the Dinyerby.
Ni Heg Willem Policy Shachon, Ian Rodayana Univira Listad occur Leshnabaj Bogashoot.
Skilty, Fis, Turmi.
Nimajigiri in Dram Honyal Ama, Tamajigiri Munchain Honyalista.
Seachtain, find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
An Irish Independent digital subscription doesn't just get you the news. It gets you the best of Ireland's stories all in one place. Whether it's the best of politics, business, sport, entertainment or lifestyle. Get it all for just €4 a month for 12 months when you first subscribe. Visit independent.ie/subscribe today. Irish Independent. Terms and conditions apply. Cancel anytime.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920. There's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
I listen to podcasts all the time, and it came up as I recommended, and it's his picture, and I did not know him from Adam. He did not look like that on the day at all. I remember the first episode, I still didn't cotton on to what I was listening to, and I went, oh my God, that's the guy. That's the fella.
I'm Not Here to Hurt You, episode 6, The Bank Teller, coming soon to all the usual spots and to independent.ie. This is an Irish Independent podcast.
Today on the Indo Daily, John Gilligan, the life and lies of Ireland's most notorious crime boss.
A very, very cold individual. Not at all warm, not endearing in any way. A man of very few words, and he's just a very cold looking individual.
John Gilligan's name has long been associated with criminal notoriety. His drug-dealing gang carried out the murder of journalist Veronica Guerin, a landmark moment in the history of the state.
There has been widespread condemnation of the killing of the crime reporter Veronica Guerin, who was shot in Dublin this afternoon. Media colleagues here, in Britain and in France, have described her death as an attack on democracy.
Yesterday, Gilligan left a Spanish court a free man, despite confessing to drugs and weapons charges and being handed a fine and a suspended prison sentence. And there's a new book and documentary out about the gangland boss.
The ruthless godfather who ruled gangland through violence and fear is credited with ushering in a new era of organised crime when he pioneered the modern narcotics trade as we know it today. And in the process, he inspired a new generation of criminals who have wreaked havoc on the streets ever since.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Paul Williams, special correspondent with the Irish Independent, to ask if what Gilligan says can be trusted. Paul, tell us, to the uninitiated, who is John Gilligan?
In a single sentence, John Gilligan is one of Ireland's most notorious and hated criminals.
And what's his background, and how did he arrive to achieve such a reviled status?
He was one of the original brat pack of young thugs from the 50s, the 60s, who grew up and were getting involved in trouble, who then went on to become the first generation of major godfathers and players. The biography I wrote about him a few years ago, I said he's the gangster who changed the face of organised crime in Ireland. He certainly did that.
And how did he do that?
Well, John Gilligan, when he was a young lad, was always involved in crime, obviously, like a lot of them. And he was a contemporary of Martin Cahill, John Traynor, George Mitchell, the Penguin, all these particular characters. And he started work on B&I line with his father. And he was part of a big criminal cartel that took over that company, effectively, and almost drove it into the ground. And he went on from that, and as a result of being involved in theft from the ships, the ferry ships with the B&I line, he developed an interest and specialization whereby he was basically responsible and ran for several years a systemic burglary gang which specialized in the wholesale robbery of factories and warehouses, not now just breaking in and taking a few things. He would go in and take a 40-foot truck full of televisions, and there were the times when televisions were bulky affairs, and video records. He stole millions upon millions of pounds worth of stuff. Anything that he could steal in large numbers and sell on the street, he was doing. So he had that very unique niche market for himself. By 1987, there were three police sort of Garda report on the state of organised crime in Ireland. There were three main players involved. The number one player on the Garda radar at the time was a fellow called Martin Cahill, the general. And the two other people significantly who were considered within that group of the top three was one, a young fellow called Gerard Hutch, the monk, who had just pulled off in 1987 the biggest cash robbery at that stage in the country. And the other was John Gilligan, who ran, he was known as Factory John, the factory gang. And it was there. By then, he was a very major player on the scene. The police come after him. They finally catch up with him. They caught up with him several times. His modus operandi was to threaten any witnesses or people who were prepared to give evidence against him, literally sticking a shotgun down their throats, giving the two fingers to the courts in front of everybody. Eventually, he was brought before the Special Criminal Court in 1990, and he got 5 years in prison for theft. And that's where the story of organised crime changes, because he went into Portlaoise Prison, which became a sort of like the alma mater of organised crime today. He started meeting young criminals who became his lieutenants, like Brian Meehan, Peter Mitchell, these guys who were also incarcerated, Paul Ward. And they kept talking to him about the drug trade, this new trade, especially in ecstasy and cannabis, not heroin. They didn't want to go into heroin. Heroin was seen as bad luck or bad, but too much, too toxic. And he decided, I'm going to get involved in this business. And he came out of prison in 1993, and he said he'd never go back to prison again. And he was going to get involved in the drug trade with his friend John Traynor.
So he literally just switched from being a thief to a drug dealer.
That's right. He and Traynor got into the cannabis business, built up their contacts in Europe, and became, over the period of less than 2 years, the biggest drug suppliers to the Irish market. And they, at the time, they turned over the equivalent in today's money of at least 100 million euro, which is still only chicken feed compared to what the Kinahans and people like that are doing. But it was he who ushered in the system.
So a very dangerous, violent man was quite content to threaten people who came in his path. Tell us about Veronica Gearn and how she put John Gilligan on the national radar.
By about 1994, 95, he was becoming a major, major player. And he and his wife had invested in this, were converting this land out in Mucklan near Enfield into a world-class equestrian centre. And the money was being shoveled into this place. But the money, there was no visible means of income to furnish the money for this. And the Gardaí started, they were talking to me about it at the time, and they talked to anyone who would listen. This guy is on social welfare, dole. His family are all on social welfare, yet he's a multimillionaire style of living. So Veronica went and asked a question that everybody wanted to ask, and that was, John Gilligan, where'd you get the money? Now, to just rewind a little bit, around this time when Veronica went to see him and put him on the map around 1995, Gilligan had been written to by the Revenue, because the guards were talking to everybody, saying, please help us here. Like, we got to get these guys. These guys are abusing the social welfare. Social welfare went after his daughter, and he rang up and threatened them. And on the file, and I found it afterwards, subsequently, on the file, they said, no more action against this man. This man's a dangerous criminal. I actually read that handwritten note on his files. And that was because years earlier, his cohort and contemporary, Martin Cahill, blew up a state forensic scientist and then abducted and shot in the legs a senior social welfare inspector. So he was following on from that. And he thought he could act with complete impunity. The Revenue wrote to him, please send us back a tax return. And he wrote, F off, on the envelope, put it back and sent it back in the post.
So complete disregard for the state.
Oh, yeah.
And was just acting as he saw fit.
When Veronica Gearn arrived out in September of 1995, she went out to ask the question that the state should have been asking. And she just said, I'd like to know where you got your money. Now, We're hearing about all these lies that he's telling and propagating, which all Gilligan ever did. How do you know John Gilligan is telling lies? He's opened his mouth and spoken. He claims that he never beat her up. He beat her up savagely. As a result of that, and this at this stage, when he beat her up, Veronica up, and threatened to kill her, his gang was on average bringing in £300,000 to £400,000 worth of hash a week. It was a vast operation. He was going to go to jail. And he was going to go to jail because he attacked her, and based on his record. And he decided he wasn't going to go to jail. And therefore, he plotted to have Veronica murdered. He sent his gang out to do it. Now he's trying to claim, oh, the gang, my gang did this, but they did it in my name, or they didn't do it in my name. All nonsense. And that's why he had her murdered. And we had there was loads of witnesses to testify to that.
And who were the individuals involved in that murder in?
Ms. Guerin was gunned down in her car as she waited at traffic lights on the Naas dual carriageway. Two men on a Dublin-registered motorbike drove alongside. The pillion passenger opened fire. In the past 2 years, she had been the subject of two previous gun attacks.
Brian Meehan rode the motorbike. Brian Meehan, he was the only member of the gang to be convicted of Veronica's murder. Patrick Dutchie Holland, who is dead. He died in a cell, in a cell in Pentonville Prison in UK. He was a lifelong professional and sinister hitman for hire. There were others involved, like John Traynor, we reckon, gave the information to the gang. He knew this was going to happen, but he didn't try and stop it. Charlie Bowden, who became a state witness, he was an ex-army guy. He prepared the gun. Russell Warren, who also became a supergrass against Gilligan and other members of the gang, he was sent to Naas to watch Veronica and actually witnessed her being shot dead. When they arrested, he was charged with the murder of Veronica. He was also charged with possession of firearms, and he was also charged with drug trafficking. He was eventually brought back to face trial, and he went on trial in 2000, and this straddled Christmas and into 2001. The reason he got away with murder, he intimidated two vital witnesses. His former lover was a girl called Carol Rooney. She was a 19-year-old, and he was, I think, twice her age at the time. She witnessed the entire build-up to Veronica's murder, including she was with him on the day in a hotel in Amsterdam on the day that Veronica was murdered. And he coordinated everything. And she describes in great detail him pacing up and down the room, demanding to know what was going on. And one of the conversations you had with Dutchie Holland, he starts laughing. He says, "I see you put a smile on her face. I wonder what criminal she's going to be writing about in heaven." Carol Rooney, he basically told that day, "I'm going to kill you and I'll kill your family." Now, she was this impressionable young kid, 19 years of age, a child. He basically threatened her, along with Dutchie Holland, in London, and put her on a plane about a month after Veronica's murder. And she went away and she never came back. The guards arrested her at one stage, talked to her and said, she gave them a very long statement. I read the statement. Powerful, powerful stuff. And she just was too scared to give evidence. Now, the significance of her evidence was that it became an essential part. It was an essential piece of the jigsaw that put the whole story together. She would have corroborated all the evidence, other evidence that wasn't accepted by the judges because it was uncorroborated. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, basically, he walked. And another guy was Martin Baltus, another witness against him. He had been the supplier of the guns and drugs from Amsterdam. His daughter was kidnapped in the Christmas break in the middle of Gilligan's trial. And he came back and told them, "By the way, I can't testify." Now, that's the reason why John Gilligan, we're listening to his voice on television at the moment.
The murder of Veronica Guerin really shocked the nation, and it shocked the state into action. We saw the subsequent establishment of the Criminal Assets Bureau and a massive manhunt and investigation into that murder. What ultimately does John Gilligan go to prison for then, and for how long?
Well, he was, as a result of his trial, he was acquitted of murder. But most significantly, the judges said that they clearly suspected very strongly that he was responsible for Veronica's murder. But the evidence, they said, wasn't there. Just in the way that the court, and that's why that court is so respected and fair. It's the same way they did their judgment in relation to Jerry Hutch. They found him not guilty of the firearms. They imported vast amounts of firearms. Again, that was because Baltus didn't give evidence. But he was caught on the third one, which was drug trafficking, and they gave him something like 27 years. As a lot of people would say that he was actually convicted. He was convicted of drug trafficking but sentenced for murder. because nobody had ever got a sentence like that, an exemplary sentence. And he ended up spending about 17 years in prison, which was good. Kept him off the streets. And then he came out and he started causing trouble. And the Kinahans went, said, you know, John, this is a different world that you left 17, 18 years ago. He started going around putting the squeeze on younger drug dealers and saying, I want money, welcome home money, he was calling it this back in 2013 into 14. And they decided, we're going to kill him. And he miraculously survived. But what that did was it finally dented that incredible arrogance and sense of omnipotence that he has about himself. That was the first time that he looked humbled. And we had a famous picture, an exclusive picture, on the front of the Irish Independent around that time when he was taken out of hospital. Here was this cowering figure in a wheelchair, terrified for his life that they were going to kill him. And he went off to England for a couple of years. Then he came back when everybody kissed and made up. He came back around the time of the Kinahan Hutch feud broke out.
This individual, he's a criminal, he's a thug, he's a compulsive liar. And we now have basically a book and a documentary being made about him, with him speaking on it, giving him a platform. Let's go through some of the claims, we'll have to describe them as in capital letters, that he's making. What's he saying about the murder of Veronica Guerin?
I know to do with Veronica Guerin's murder. Miss Guerin, Lord Messner, she never wrote one word about me. You know, nothing.
Do you accept you assaulted her?
Pardon?
Do you accept you assaulted her?
No, I didn't.
I didn't.
And I've seen people say, I admitted this. I didn't know such thing.
He's saying that from we know so far, he's saying that it was that his gang did it without his knowledge. It had nothing to do with him.
Right, so it's his gang, he's in charge of them, but he didn't know.
Not in Look, which completely lacks any kind of credibility. Okay. And of course, if we had ever heard Carol Rooney's statements, which were ever put into evidence, that would have changed all of that. So that was the first one. The only piece of truth that I know of that he has spoken apparently in this documentary is that he says that Brian Meehan was involved in the murder. Well, dearie me, Sherlock, we all know that.
Yeah.
He was convicted in 1999, and then he claims that Charlie Bowden was actually the gunman. Charlie Bowden had a cast iron alibi. In fact, all the claims he has made around this, he claims he didn't beat up Veronica, he didn't do this.
Yeah, on the Jessbrook attack, all of that. He's saying he didn't beat her up.
Reading Liam Collins, our colleague in Sunday Indo, and Liam was on the desk that time, and everybody in the Sunday Independent, and him included, saw the wounds on her. Now, the other thing, the most despicable and hideous thing that this individual has said, and is shocking and it is disgusting and it illustrates the caliber of the creature we're talking about. And he claims that Veronica organized to have herself shot in the leg. When she was, people remember, in 1995, she was shot, and she was lucky she survived because the bullet narrowly missed her artery.
The shooting happened shortly after 7 o'clock this evening. A man dressed in motorcycle clothing came to the door of Miss Guerin's home in Clochran, North County Dublin. According to Garda sources, the man pointed a gun at Miss Guerin's head, then lowered his aim and shot her in the leg.
There was another shooting incident at Veronica's house where a bullet was fired outside the door to threaten her, to warn her off. This is the very early stages. He claimed that she did this herself. Nonsense.
This murder that was perpetrated by his gang, he claims without his knowledge, he says of the murder weapon, which was never found, he says it will never be found. What does he mean? What's he talking about there?
Well, we always wondered about that. That's a quote that's been lingering around the place for quite some time. And the gun never was found. The people who got rid of the gun, they also got rid of the motorbike that was used. He seems to be quite sure. There was one stage, there was a belief that it was dumped on open ground in Old County Road in Crumlin. Then they searched, a very large section of the River Liffey, where the near Ligslip Lucan, where the bike was dumped. And they thought maybe the gun was there, but the gun never was found. So that remains a mystery that will never be solved.
What sort of weapon was it?
It was a .357 Magnum, the Dirty Harry gun. A deadly piece of kit, the Clint Eastwood line, the most powerful handgun in the world. And it was dumped and never found, and that was there was a huge effort made to get that, and there was a lot of people broke in the gang who talked about that.
Could have been thrown in a river, could have just been buried in a hole, it could have been thrown down a sewer. We'll never know. And he's saying it'll never be found, so despite not knowing allegedly anything about it. What's he saying about the money he made from drug dealing?
Made something like 12 million from drug dealing. That would be about right. He claims he lost an absolute fortune over 20 years in gambling. He was making huge money.
Hmm.
At one stage, Charlie Bowden was a member of the gang, and he told the story, and he was getting a chunk off the profit, but he was way down the food chain. And he actually described how he got a laundry basket and he filled it with cash. And one of the guards said to him, well, what happened when you filled that with cash? He said, well, I went out and got another one.
Right.
So like it was like the Keens years ago down in Limerick. They used to hide their money, stash it in a wheelie bin. So like the money they were making was extraordinary at the time. And when all this started spilling out, when the Criminal Assets Bureau was set up as a result of Gilligan's actions and the murder of Veronica, like the public were stunned at the levels, the kind of money that he was bringing in at the time. And that was the first realisation that we had a problem with organised crime here, which, of course, up to that time, the guards were like the ostriches, their heads in the sand. They didn't want to. And in fact, they used to bar the term organised crime. Garda headquarters did. No such thing as organised crime in Ireland. Or, by the way, millionaire drug traffickers. In fact, he laundered most of his money through gambling, and it's a complicated sort of matrix, but also not complicated at the same time. He would basically go in and bet on all the horses in the various races, chunks of money. He actually lost something like, over this period of 2 years, he gambled something like 15 million. He lost, and when you put in the tax and what he actually lost, it came in less than 20% what he would have had to pay in corporation tax to the taxman. So it was a very, very
efficient way of going about laundering your money. He's talking about, I'm going to hell, whether he believes in heaven and hell, you know, more bravado from him. What is your take on affording somebody like this a platform?
First of all, as a journalist, Fionnán, us as journalists, the last thing we can do at any stage is to turn around and give out about somebody else's scoop. It's a spectacular scoop for Jason O'Toole, and well done, the journalist who broke this story, and for the people in TV3 to decide to make a documentary about it. It's up to the journalist's job is to tell the story. I personally will look at it, perhaps, maybe not, because I've had so many dealings with that guy through the years. I know so much about him. I know he's telling lies, and he's just, and I used this term before, and I hope it doesn't upset any of our listeners, but he's just a scumbag. He's just a predatory, low-life thug who has lied and bullied his way through life. And the arrogance of the man, like, it upsets us because we come from the stable where Veronica was murdered and the home, and it affected a lot of our lives. In terms of what he has to say, he's just telling lies and trying to rationalise himself.
My thanks to Paul Williams. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode was produced by Mary Carroll and Garrett Mulhall, researched by Sylvia O'Morodion, with sound by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from RTE, The Irish Mirror, CBS and Independent.ie. If you enjoy The Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow and leave us a review.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave, 1919, 1920. There's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.